Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, during his annual State of the Union address, President Obama said he will not rule out any option to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, but said a, quote, peaceful resolution of this issue is still possible and far better, and if Iran changes course and meets its obligations, it can rejoin the community of nations. But at the same time, the United States and the European Union have been ratcheting up economic pressure on Iran by imposing new sanctions to restrict Iran's ability to sell its oil. And they're doing this by banning American dealings with Iran's central bank. The EU has banned all purchases of Iranian oil. Iran has threatened to respond to these sanctions by closing the Strait of Hormuz, a vital pathway for global oil supplies. And then in November, the White House seized upon the latest report from the International Atomic Energy Agency to renew the U.S. claim that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapon. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said, quote, a very grave threat to all of us. We have not taken any options off the table. But just yesterday, a new report by the Institute for Science and International Security says Iran is unlikely to move towards building a nuclear weapon this year because it cannot yet produce enough weapon-grade uranium and is being deterred by sanctions and the prospect of an Israeli attack. Today, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said Iran is ready to revive talks with the West, but tougher sanctions will not force it to give in to demands over its nuclear program. So what do these escalating tensions mean? Is this election year talk? Or, as some have been arguing, are these sanctions paving the way to a military confrontation with Iran? Kaveh Ehsani is Assistant Professor of International Studies at DePaul University. He's also contributing editor to the Middle East Report. And Kaveh joins us from Chicago. Hi, Kaveh. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you.
We're also joined by Chris Tonzing, Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project in Washington and editor of its quarterly magazine, The Middle East Report. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Kaveh, let's start off with you. How do you explain all of the rhetoric that we're hearing right now? The cover of this weekend's New York Times magazine says Israel versus Iran. The lengthy piece, Will Israel Attack Iran? And Israel's been talking about a nuclear weapon in Iran since 1992. So why is this happening right now?
Well, I think if you recall, you know, a couple of years back, the same kind of rhetoric was very much in the air. Israel was, there were all these leaks, supposed leaks about, you know, Israeli military practicing, sending dogs with explosives down tunnels, to practice attacking Iran's underground nuclear facilities. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that has been floating around for a couple of decades, actually. And it resurfaces every now and then. I think you look at the bigger picture of Middle East. I think there's a big realignment in process. I think all the political players, including the U.S., Israel, Iran, other Arab countries in the region, are highly concerned. The future is unclear. And I think there's a lot of anxieties and planning ahead to see how, you know, this new chess game will be set. As far as the U.S. is concerned, I think the big anxiety and the reason, which is behind the reason for this kind of heightened rhetoric, is the fact that the U.S. is vacating militarily Iraq and Afghanistan. And there's a big anxiety over the vacuum that will be left once the U.S. troops leave. That vacuum will be filled with, Iranian influence. Iran is well placed to extend its geopolitical influence in the two neighboring countries. And I think weakening Iran in all sorts of different ways, not necessarily through military confrontation, is high on U.S. policymakers' minds. And as far as Israel is concerned, I mean, I think, you know, they're looking at their neighborhood events in Syria, in Egypt, the Arab Spring, and there is a heightened concern among Israelis their big adversary, which is Iran, should also be weakened so it doesn't take advantage of, you know, all this kind of realignment that is going on. So I think it's more than Iran's nuclear program a lot.
Right. And so you brought up a lot of points, and we'll elaborate on all of those on today's show. But before we do that, Chris, what would you add?
I think
Kaveh is right on, that there is a concatenation of factors that is sort of conspiring together at this particular historical moment to explain the sort of era of crisis that exists now. And the one player I would add is the Saudi Arabia and the other Arab Gulf states, who have a long history of being worried about Iranian influence in their domestic affairs, whether because of their Shiite populations or for other reasons, and are also worried about Iranian greater influence, great power status slash hegemony in the Gulf. And I think those powers are very much, have been very much on the defensive in the last year because of the revolts happening across the Arab world. They have, particularly Saudi Arabia, seized the mantle of counter-revolution. And one of the ways in which they're doing so is stoking and aiding and abetting this Iran war talk at every opportunity.
But there is something tangible in all of this, and that is the sanctions. The U.S. and the EU have been ratcheting up economic pressure by imposing new sanctions to restrict Iran's ability to sell its oil. Kaveh, tell us about these sanctions, and what do you think of them? How will they affect the Iranian people?
Well, you know, Iran is probably the country with the longest experience of international sanctions. I mean, it has been under one or another form of sanctions since 1980s, early 1980s. So it's a state that actually knows how to deal with them, how to get around them. It has extended its informal networks of trade and dealings across the globe, and it's very active in that. But I think the difference in this round of sanctions is that it is seriously involving the European Union, and it's targeting Iran's oil and as well as its financial networks. The impact of sanctions are kind of complex. At one level, I don't think they're really hurting the Iranian state. Any kind of threat to you know, the withdrawal of Iranian oil from the global markets will lead to a rise in price of oil. And so long as they have customers, and they do, you know, in China, in other Asian countries, for example, as long as they can extend and maintain those contacts, the state will not be harmed. It is really the ordinary Iranians that are hurting more than anything from these sanctions. I mean, you look at it is ironic that the U.S. administration always discusses, you know, its sympathy for the ordinary Iranians living under the tyranny of this government and so on and so forth. But it is really the private sector and the middle class and the ordinary Iranians, working people, who are really suffering. I'll give you one example. These sanctions, which are supposed to be targeted and a sharp tool to kind of curtail the power of the military and the, you know, security apparatus in Iran, are really blunt instruments. They're targeting ordinary businessmen. For example, I know people who have you know, music production companies. I have a friend who's one of his recordings was nominated for a Grammy in the United States, and he basically is on the verge of bankruptcy because his credit card through which he was selling his CDs abroad has been suspended. There are other companies that I can mention, you know, ordinary middling companies involved in environmental projects, composting and such, that have lost all their business because they cannot maintain a bank account in Dubai or in the Gulf or in the European countries anymore. So it's really a blunt instrument that is affecting the price of imports of ordinary things, including gasoline, which is meant for transport and so on. So it's really impoverishing the ordinary Iranians. And its impacts are beginning to look like what it looked like in Iraq in the 1990s. What happened with the sanctions in Iraq in 1990s was that it really impoverished the civil society. It really hollowed it out, and it weakened it. It's, in the end, it wasn't the Iraqis who overthrew Saddam Hussein. It was American tanks. And You know, the same kind of effect is, you know, can be felt in among ordinary Iranians as a result of these sanctions.
The UN estimates 500,000 children were killed by malnutrition and disease as a result of the sanctions in Iraq. So, Kaveh, why do you think the U.S. would do this? A U.S. official was quoted in a CNN article specifically about the sanctions, saying, "You can see quite graphically how the efforts we've been engaged in over the last several years have intensified over the last several months and are really starting to have a very palpable impact." Why is the U.S. What is the U.S. trying to accomplish by imposing these harsh sanctions?
I think at some point with the Obama administration, oddly enough, I think the U.S. basically gave up the idea that domestic politics in Iran matters at all. I think this is lazy foreign policy making, which will kind of explode like a petard in our face. I think the U.S. is convinced that no matter what kind of factional fighting or domestic politics and strife takes place in Iran, it is of no concern to the U.S. as long as whoever is in charge in Iran, through whatever means, is willing to negotiate from a position of weakness with the U.S. and basically accept to give up its influence in Iraq and Afghanistan and sit at the negotiation table and so-called, you know, join the community of nations. I think it's, you know, at this point, anything that weakens the whatever dominant faction in Iranian politics is perceived to be in the U.S. interest. And I think this is very short-sighted. I think it's not a clever politics, and I think in the end it will really kind of backfire.
And Iran's currency has lost over 70% of its value against the dollar since September. This is again according to this unnamed U.S. official. Does that sound right to you, Kaveh?
Yeah, it's been going up and down like a yo-yo. It actually lost almost it almost halved in value, and just today it was announced that the central bank was stepping in and shoring up the hard currency market. And but that's a result. That's a reaction. That's a panic reaction as a result of the sanctions and their consequences. There's a lot of people who are trying to park whatever funds they have into hard currency or gold or whatever form of secure assets that they can get their hands on, or to kind of get it out of the country in any way they can, because they fear not necessarily a military situation. They fear the instability that the Iranian economy has been chronically dealing with, not just as a result of the sanctions, but also really poor populistic policies of the Ahmadinejad administration.
And Chris, how do you explain the Obama administration's decision to toughen these sanctions? Why are they doing this?
Well, I think if you look at who the personnel have been making some of these decisions, I would focus on one person, Dennis Ross, who is not in the administration any longer. He left at the beginning or at the end of last year, citing family reasons, and that he was only going to serve for 2 years. But before he was brought into the Obama administration, Dennis Ross was a signatory to a report produced by something called the Bipartisan Policy Center, which was essentially a neocon front group, which specifically recommended an Iran policy where sanctions and various other kinds of non-military pressure were applied to Iran as a way of making more acceptable what are called more kinetic options in Washington, meaning some various kinds of military strikes upon Iran. In other words, sanctions, hawk engagement, if you prefer, were explicitly conceived as things that would pave the way towards more aggressive options. And I think basically what happened during Dennis Ross's tenure in the administration, and he was certainly not the only person pushing this approach inside the administration, is that that policy was pretty much set by the administration. And I think Ross left in part because he thought that he had done his bit to put the U.S. on a track of confrontation with Iran, as well as the damage he did to the Israeli-Palestinian file. I think that there is, as usual, there's a very heavy influence of the pro-Israel lobby on this policy. One should not overestimate that, of course. In many ways, the pro-Israel lobby pushes it at an open door in Washington when it comes to Iran. You're not going to find any American politician of any party who is willing to say nice things about Iran. Iran bashing is a cost-free activity for any politician of whatever ideological persuasion because of the hostage crisis and the deep American trauma that occurred then, which can be mobilized by any politician for aggressive policies toward Iran. There's this long history of enmity between the two countries that is very difficult for Washington, the political culture in Washington, to transcend. It creates an environment in which lobby groups can push for ever more aggressive policies.
That is Chris Townsend. He is executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of its quarterly magazine, The Middle East Report. We're also joined by Kaveh Ehsani, assistant professor of international studies at DePaul University and contributing editor to The Middle East Report. And today we are talking about Iran. You are hearing so many media reports about Israel, Iran, the U.S., and the sanctions. What's missing from the coverage? What questions do you still have about this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you think the Obama administration's policy toward Iran should be? And if you're an Iranian-American, what are you hearing from family and friends in Iran? And what are your thoughts on this? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, you can post a comment to our new website, yourcallradio.org. And Chris, talk a little bit more about some of the reasonings behind this, because a lot of people are saying, is this just election talk? I mean, we could have done this show, this exact show last year, or right before the last election. Or is this serious? But you're both talking about the vacuum left in Iraq and Afghanistan, the fact that these other forces want to minimize the influence and weaken Iran. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I do think that there is a big component of election year politics here. I mean, certainly if you look at what the GOP candidates say, they're tripping over themselves to outflank Obama on his right with regard to Iran and accusing him of appeasement and worse. So certainly part of what Obama is trying to do is position himself for the general election as, you know, just as hawkish as whoever the Republican nominee will be. And that of course, is a pattern in American politics that goes back to the Vietnam War that the Democratic Party refuses to transcend. And, of course, they always lose that battle. They will always lose it.
Well, and this is nothing new, because I was just looking online. Newt Gingrich was asked on the campaign stump, would you attack Iran? And I just got an article from 2008 where Newt Gingrich said Israel should set a deadline for attack on Iran.
Right. So that's a factor. But I do think that I do, and I would be interested to hear Kaveh's thoughts about this, but I do take this current round of war talk far more seriously than the past rounds. Mm-hmm. I am actually quite worried about this round. And the reasons are because of the international environment is just different now. And one factor is, for example, if we look at Israel, the Saudis, et cetera, one factor is, you know, what's happening in the region with Syria, for example. I think some elements of the Israeli security establishment are calculating that now is the time to push for a possible strike on Iran because Syria, Iran's chief ally in the Middle East, is utterly consumed with an internal revolt. And the idea would be that Syria would not be able to function as a corridor for resupplying Hezbollah in Lebanon with missiles and other armaments. So if there were to be a strike on Iran now, that Iran's ability to retaliate through a proxy and Hezbollah against Israel, for example, would be limited, whereas in the past it might not have been. So I think that's one factor that makes that gives the war talk more of a serious edge now than it had in the past. And the other thing I worry about is and this we you know we saw this in the experience of the interminable lead up to the war in Iraq, which you know most people think started with the Bush administration, but actually goes back to the Clinton administration, and there was this ever tightening downward spiral of bellicose rhetoric on both sides, but mostly, you know, the West is mostly to blame because they're the ones with the power. And what happens is that to some extent, both sides, and the U.S. in particular, get stuck in their own rhetoric. And they really do, you really do have a situation where a presidential administration finds itself in a position where it has defined the only political acceptable options as a humiliating climb down, which would be politically impossible for it domestically, or war. And that is what I really worry about, you know, in the U.S. Calculus with this current round of war talk, is that the Obama administration is narrowing the options for itself.
Hmm. Well, we'll get Kaveh's response to that in just a minute. Let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. So my question for the panelists is there a sense that maybe the U.S. is emboldened to really step up sanctions, because ultimately the first strike militarily will come from Israel, and maybe not even the first strike, maybe the entire military confrontation will be through Israel, through Israeli troops, and that, does that perhaps free the U.S. to be a little bit more emboldened at this time?
Kaveh, do you want to take that one?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not a, you know, military expert, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know if what kind of capability Israel has to undertake a massive, you know, military attack on Iran, and what would it be attacking exactly? You know, Iran's nuclear facilities, which are, you know, a couple of hundred meters underground, you know, a non-functioning nuclear reactor on the Persian Gulf. You know, there's, you know, Iran's nuclear facilities are spread out on a pretty vast territory. And if they're struck, I mean, you know, often it's been said by military experts that, okay, it will set them back for a year, a couple of years, and then they'll rebuild. And they might be even able to defend it. And meanwhile, Iran will respond in, you know, through proxies, you know, maybe Hezbollah, but, you know, certainly in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Saudi Arabia, which, you know, which has a significant Shia population, which are, you know, treated as second-class citizens. Look, I mean, the U.S. is, I see Chris's fears that this round of talks are more dangerous, mm-hmm. but I think U.S. is fighting a war, several wars in Iran already. There is a rising, mounting ethnic strife on Iran's borders, which it has come out recently more explicitly that it is being supported directly or indirectly by the U.S. This is in Balochistan, in Azerbaijan, in Kurdistan. And to some extent in Khuzestan. So, you know, various ethnicities, Sunnis in Iran, which are treated as second-class citizens, various unhappy, you know, ethnic populations which have brethren across the border, are restless in present circumstances in Iran. Then there is the sanctions, which is economic warfare, which, as I said, is really kind of putting tremendous pressure on, you know, on ordinary Iranians and possibly with the idea of making them discontent.
And Kaveh, hold that thought. We have to take a quick break, but I'd like you to elaborate on this because we're not hearing much about ethnic strife on the borders. Today we're talking about what's happening with Iran, Israel, and the West. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
You're tuned to KALW San Francisco, and if you have not visited KALW.org lately, it's changed a lot. The redesigned design is aimed at making it easier for you to find the information that you want and for you to be able to share the programming you value on KALW with people you know. However, it's a work in progress, and we need your help to make it better. So check out the new KALW.org to see what you think and send us any suggestions you have for improvements. And during this January membership drive, It's the ideal place for you to make a contribution to support your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco. Go to kalw.org and thank you for supporting your local public radio station.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments to our new website so everyone else can read them. Or you can email your comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also call 866-798-8255. Today we are talking about what is really happening with Iran. This weekend, the New York Times is running a magazine, lengthy magazine piece called Will Israel Attack Iran? During the State of the Union address this week, President Obama said he will not rule out any option for preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Just yesterday, a new report by the Institute for Science and International Security says Iran is unlikely to move towards building a weapon this year because it cannot yet produce enough weapon-grade uranium, and it's being deterred by sanctions and the prospect of an Israeli attack. So what are your thoughts about all of this? How are you making sense of this? And if you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. We hear so much of the same rhetoric on a regular basis, especially around election time. But as today's guests say, they're a little more worried about the rhetoric this time because the Middle East looks so different this time around. So what are your thoughts on that? And if you're an Iranian American, what are you hearing from family and friends in Iran? And how concerned are you about these sanctions? 866-798-8255. feedback@yourcallradio.org. And before we get back to calls, Kaveh, you're bringing up some comments here that I have not heard before. So you're saying that the U.S. is actually already fighting several wars in Iran, the ethnic strife on the borders. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, there is encouragement, at least in Balochistan, which borders, Pakistan and Afghanistan, with a Sunni minority, which are under tremendous pressure from the central Iranian government. Okay. And there's been a guerrilla terrorist organization called Jandallah, which has come out more recently, that they have been supplied and supported, directly or indirectly by the United States. There is, strings of other ethnic discontent in Azerbaijan, in northwest Iran, in Kurdistan, in Khuzestan, which is Arab speaking. Iran is dealing at currently with a mounting ethnic discontent on its borders, which is becoming more and more vocal. There's the economic warfare of sanctions, and there's this string of assassinations of nuclear scientists that we see that are obviously acts, organized acts that are supported by probably discontent Iranian groups abroad, like the Mujahideen probably, but possibly supported by Israel or the United States. So there's definitely this siege mentality within the Iranian state that sees itself under direct attack, or indirect attack, I should say, through these other, confrontational means. United States doesn't need necessarily at this point to confront Iran militarily. Just think about the consequences. Will the U.S. be able to deal with the fallout? Obviously it can handle Iran militarily in a direct confrontation, but there's always a fallout afterwards, as we saw in Iraq. If it leads to some kind of falling apart of the Iranian state, or its response through proxies in neighboring countries, it will have to retaliate. This will be really costly for the United States. It will lead to serious disruptions in all neighboring countries as well as in Iran. It will affect the price of oil significantly because, we will deal with much more a situation of greater insecurity throughout the region. It will have economic consequences. It will have military consequences for a United States that is in the middle of a serious recession, for a global economy that cannot handle a huge spike in oil prices and significant disruptions in the Middle East. So I think it's not an option. Military confrontation is not an option that anyone at this point would treat, would be kind of reckless with. It's just too costly, in my opinion.
It's hard to believe that we so easily can talk about military strikes.
Well, talk is cheap. I mean, as I said, this is the question. What will be struck? You know, Iran's nuclear facilities, two, three different nuclear facilities, Iran's infrastructure, that's a much more, significant target. It has greater consequences. I mean, maybe confronting a gunboat in the Persian Gulf is one thing that can be curtailed. But if it's on a bigger scale, first of all, we have to see if a country like Israel has the capability to attack a country as far away as Iran, with significant results or not. And secondly, we'll have to see how Iran will retaliate. Not necessarily in a confrontational manner. Militarily, it will retaliate through proxies. And all these have great consequences. And the point is, can the global economy, can the U.S. military handle the consequences that can be predicted? At this point, I think everybody's so stretched to their limits with their capabilities, economically, militarily, geostrategically, that I think this option is not a win-win situation for Israel or for the U.S. So the rhetoric is there, I think. The rhetoric has been there. But how serious it is, how serious is this saber rattling, I'm a little bit more skeptical about.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's go through a few calls and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Sean in San Francisco. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I'm trying to recall when Iran ever really attacked a country. I mean, Iran is always being attacked, but I can't recall in history when Iran actually attacked a country.
All right. Thank you for the call, Sean. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
Hi. As the answer to the last caller, Iran did not attack any country since Cyrus the Great 2,400 years ago. Israel attacked its neighbor over 100 times, including seven major wars. My point is, even if Iran have the nuclear issue is really an excuse, it is a continuation of a project for new American century. Somebody already mentioned Diane Ross.
Dennis Ross.
Dennis Ross, yeah. As well as, Wolf was, and he sees him in the interviewing the Republicans and all the thing. The fact is, it is extremely dangerous even consider doing this war. It is the worst thing Israel could do. It is actually, I really like to call it this wish to do that. And I also like to bring some very important issue, the assassination of a Middle Eastern scientist. More Egyptian nuclear scientists were murdered by the United States and Israel in the last 60 years. One was a woman, her name was Samira Musa. She was invited to the United States to visit Oak Ridge Lab in Tennessee, and Los Alamos Lab in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and she was invited to come to California to visit Livermore, and she was murdered in the way by her car. The driver driving her car jumped from the car, and the car went over a cliff, and she was killed. Everybody tried to Google search Samira, S-A-M-I-R-A, Musa, M-O-U-S-A, and you will see, and there are also several Egyptian scientists were killed, including one in Paris about 10 years ago. The whole thing doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It is Project New American Century. It is a new conservative. And everybody to see what Obama just nothing, another puppet in their hand. And Gingrich will definitely be far worse than Obama, but they all come from the same thing. And, the last point I'd like to make, I'm really sorry taking so much time, to say that in the long run, you will never have peace, at least, with the current form of the state of Israel. Of course, the people of Israel have to continue living there as they wish. But as long as Israel have this shape of a government, totally warmongering, totally war hawkish and all of that, and totally controlling the United States, you will never have peace.
Thank you for calling. We'll get a response in just a minute from both of our guests. Let's go next to Zia in San Rafael. Hi, Zia. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I have one comment, and that is that unfortunately the Americans do not see that Iranians are not blind. They have eyes and they see. Just like Dennis Ross. Now, recently, President Obama has appointed a person by the name of Jacob Lew, L-E-W, who formerly, just about 2 or 3 years ago, he was the executive director of MEMRI. It's Middle East Media Research Institute, and it is rumored, and it's more than strong rumor, that it is an organization created by IPAC. The gentleman, he is an Orthodox Jew, and he's a Zionist, and now he's he has become the fox in charge of the hens. And would the Iranians really look at this kindly? I don't think so.
Well, thank you for calling, Zia. A lot of comments there. Chris Tonzin, are you familiar with Jacob Lew? And is that correct?
Yes, I am. You know, I honestly, I have to say I had not heard that he used to be the executive director of MEMRI. That's extremely worrisome.
Well, I'm looking online right now, and I'm seeing a few articles that say he was the recent executive editor. Why is that worrisome to you?
MEMRI is an organization founded. It's run by a former Israeli general, and it was founded basically by the pro-Israel lobby to monitor the production of the Arabic language broadcast and print media, with pretty much the explicit purpose of demonstrating the old anti-Arab racist canard that Arabs don't say one thing in English and say another thing in Arabic, and the idea would be to show that that Arabs are always putting out, for example, anti-Semitic or other kinds of objectionable things in their own media. And basically, what MEMRI does is it cherry picks from the production of the vast production of the Arabic language broadcast and print media, and picks those few things that that do express very objectionable sentiments, at least things that are viewed as objectionable in the West, and then does not translate and publicize the vast majority of things that are much more mundane. MEMRI is certainly not a politically neutral organization.
Well, do you have any other comments about the other calls? We got calls about the assassination, and no one has been arrested for that, right?
No. And the series of assassinations is certainly very worrisome. I mean, the last one, the Obama administration made a big show of distancing itself, saying that and condemning it, and saying that the U.S. certainly had nothing to do with it. Just to follow up on something that Kaveh was talking about Jundullah in Balochistan in Iran, there was a very important article by Mark Perry that appeared in Foreign Policy magazine, I think last week, where Mark Perry publicized a couple of memoranda that were drafted inside the U.S. intelligence establishment and were leaked to Perry. Presumably the timing was not accidental. And these memoranda said that some of the attacks by Jundullah upon Iranian security personnel in Iranian Balochistan that had been attributed by Tehran to the U.S. and Britain were actually engineered by the Mossad, by the Israeli Secret Service, and that this was what's called a false flag operation, that, in other words, these Israeli recruiters of the Jundullah operatives were posing as Americans so that Jundullah would themselves think that they were being sponsored by the U.S. Now, that's what Perry's U.S. intelligence sources leaked to him. So if you're really into spy novels and so on, you may think that that itself was a kind of false flag operation. But the point is that and Israel is also accused of doing things on the northern border of Iran and Iraq in the Kurdish areas, recruiting Iranian Kurds to carry out attacks on Iranian security personnel. So there is more than one actor who can be credibly accused of stirring up trouble in Iran, and the U.S. is one of them, and there are others, and that's, you know, another reason why this, I think, this new round of war talk is worrisome. And I would point again, as Kaveh did, to the action of the European Union just this past week in announcing an oil embargo upon Iran that is to take effect in the next 6 months. That is a pretty significant shift in the EU's position with regard to this whole long Iranian nuclear issue. The EU has, for the most part, they have been, aligned with the U.S. more aggressive position in comparison to Russia and China, but they have tried to be sort of the cooling saucer for, the hot American temper on this issue over the last 10 years. And now that they have apparently been pushed into this quite aggressive move of economic warfare, as Kaveh said, one that, in some ways goes beyond what the U.S. has done, is worrisome, worrisome evidence that this round of war talk is perhaps somewhat more serious than in the past. Mm.
Well, Kaveh, before we go to more callers, do you have responses for our last set of calls? A lot of issues were raised there.
No, they were good questions, and I think what Chris said, I tend to agree, Let's move on to other callers.
Okay, well, we have a number of other callers, and we're joined today by Kaveh Asane, Assistant Professor of International Studies at DePaul University, and Chris Tonzin, Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. We have about 10 more minutes, so if you'd like to call in, we have one open line, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about what's happening with Iran, the EU, the U.S., and Israel, this is getting so much attention now. What's really missing from the conversation? What questions do you have? And if you're an Iranian-American, if you're in touch with family and friends in Iran, what do they think about these sanctions and how do they think it will affect them? Well, as we heard, it's already affecting people on the ground. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Mir in Sunnyvale. Hi, Mir. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I would like to comment about the complaints that sanctions in Iran make the ordinary people, civilians in Iran, suffering. This is true, but I want to remind the listeners that what happened in Iraq in the past during the sanctions, one of the things that were exempted from sanctions were medications in order to help ordinary people. What Saddam Hussein regime did was confiscating all the medications and then sell them in outrageously high prices to people who could afford it. So it not only did the ordinary people suffer, but it actually helped the regime to gain more money when they had a shortage of it. The same goes will go for a regime that we have in Iran. It's very difficult to distinguish and to target the regime only when they control everything in the economy and around it. That's all.
Let's get a comment from Kaveh.
I think that's a point that I tried to raise, and I think it's absolutely correct. The regime of sanctions are actually consolidating the hardline elements of the Iranian state, which basically have less and less competition economically as far as they're moving into the position of occupying economic positions for themselves, benefiting as oligarchs did in Russia. You have a lot of people that are kind of, part of the conservative establishment in Iran that are, accumulating a lot of wealth, importing material that are under sanctions and marketing them. But I think what is missing from this conversation is the significant transformations that are taking place within Iran's economy and politics. I mean, there is a warfare of sorts going on within the Iranian political elite, the opposition, and ordinary people. At this point, what the sanctions and the policies of the Ahmadinejad administration are doing are weakening the Iranian opposition. They're weakening the civil society, the private sector, middle classes, working people. And what is happening, which, you know, politically in Iran, is quite significant in that regard. The establishment in Iran has been trying for the past 10 years, but at a much more accelerated pace, to kind of unify the authoritarian structures of the state, push out all of its domestic opposition, even, you know, the opposition that was part of the regime, such as the reformers and so on and so forth, and unify itself so it can negotiate with the outside world, with the United States, from a position of domestic strength. I think the elections in 2009 threw that policy into disarray because, you know, it showed that the ordinary Iranians had, you know, did not want to line up behind the leader, the Iranian leader, and toe the line. And since then, with the repression, we've had a veritable civil strife growing between Ahmadinejad and the leader Khamenei himself. And these are significant transformations that are taking place within Iran. Now, the pressure from outside is really strengthening the hand of the most conservative elements within the Iranian establishment. And this is really kind of the unfortunate byproduct of this new round of sanctions and the economic warfare that that we were talking about.
All right. Thank you for the call, Mir. And let's go next to Shadham in Oakland. Hi, Shadham. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Hello, Kaveh and Chris. Thank you so much for your comments. Actually, I was going to make a comment about the last point that Kaveh so clearly articulated about the internal factors in this, the whole equation. But since that has been said, I wanted to also ask you a question. How much of this, if you will, Serbian scenario is on the minds of the policymakers in the United States? In other words, given the fact that they know the level of disaffection within Iran, the fact that the regime is unpopular, is it possible that they're thinking that with the, and you know, if you remember, the sanctions were imposed on Yugoslavia, on Serbia in 1992, and then there was some bombing by NATO, and then there was unrest within Yugoslavia over the presidential elections. Do you think that this is the kind of scenario that is being sort of played out there by some of these policymakers in the States? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Chris, do you want to take that?
That's possible. Yeah, I mean, in general, I would say, and, you know, getting back to, you know, Kaveh's list of all the reasons why attacking Iran would be a bad idea, and which I certainly agree with, and why... U.S. policymakers and others would be very reluctant to consider that as an option. I think what is a little bit worrisome is that, you know, the consequences of doing this are well known. They have been exhaustively discussed for almost a decade now, and I think there's actually a fair amount of agreement that there would, you know, Iran would find various ways to retaliate. There would be consequences for the oil markets, the world oil markets, for the economies, and so on and so forth. But what I think, what I observe is an increasing, what I would call, tolerance for a certain level of consequence from a prospective attack on Iran. There's an acceptance, a new acceptance, that there would be consequences, that the consequences might be worth paying. You'll find Israeli officials, of course, saying that, you know, even retarding the progress of Iran's nuclear research for a matter of months would be worth paying some consequences. So I think that it may not be enough anymore to enumerate all of the reasons why attacking Iran would be a bad idea from the perspective of the United States. In other words, from a sort of realist point of view, I think politics and emotion are starting to color this debate in a way that has not been the case before.
Well, thank you for calling in, Shottam. We have just about a minute left, and I don't want to end the show without talking about the status of the Green Movement, Kaveh. International Human Rights for Iran says that today is the year anniversary of the three opposition leaders who have been under house arrest for a year. What is the status of the protest movement today?
Well, there is, you know, very little protest movement as such. I mean, you know, it's not a movement at this point. All the key organizers and leaders and link people are, you know, either arrested or in prison or have been made unemployed and, you know, marginalized. And it's, you know, it is a tremendously difficult period. But this has been the case in Iran before, and it's kind of, you know, the opposition or you know, the protest movements in Iran have a way of rising like Sphinx, because not because of their own resilience, but because it is a highly politicized society. There is the legacy of the, you know, past 30 years of a revolution which empowered ordinary people to change, you know, to change their leaders and challenge the state, and that hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, what you see now, which is quite fascinating, are these senior former members of the Revolutionary Guards, for example, coming out and talking very explicitly and publicly that, you know, this is the system that we have now is more like a monarchy than a republic, and you know, challenging the leader directly. Just in the past week or 10 days, four senior members of the Revolutionary Guards have died under mysterious circumstances. I mean, you know, it's officially said that it's because of heart attacks or various kinds of diseases or strokes. But, you know, it is a bizarre coincidence. So I think, you know, if you look at the Iranian state, it is a state that is really rife with a lot of factionalism, a lot of disagreements, and those disagreements are not horizontal. They're really vertical. They run through all institutions, including the Revolutionary Guards, including the state apparatus, the bureaucracy, the political elite.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we will definitely continue following this issue. Kaveh Ehsani, Assistant Professor of International Studies at DePaul University, Chris Tonzin, Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for your phone calls, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. With so much talk about how much Mitt Romney paid in taxes, how are the media covering our tax system? We'll also discuss the growing debt crisis in Europe and the ongoing debt relief deal talks in Greece, where the names of 4,000 tax evaders have been published. We'll be joined by Reuters' David K. Johnston, and the Globe and Mail's Eric Reguli joins us from Rome. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.